This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Firefighters in California are still patrolling the edges of the Rocky Fire up near Sonoma after it raged through nearly 70,000 acres. Today, the fire is still smoldering, but mostly contained. And contain is what we do, right? When fires start, we put them out as quickly as we can. It's a policy we followed for about 100 years out west. And as a result, today's forests are so clogged with debris, kindling essentially, that fire can easily rip through tens of thousands of acres without running out of fuel, leaving what was once a forest looking like a charred moonscape. But there is one place where they don't try to put out natural fires. Maybe you've heard of it, Yosemite National Park. And it's become an interesting testbed for some of the changes that have happened to the plants, the soil, and the water after frequent, less severe fires take back the land. And the results are surprising, and that's what we're going to talk about, partly about the forest fires in Yosemite with my next guest, Scott Stevens, professor of fire science in the Department of Environment Science, Policy, and Management, UC Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Sally Thompson, professor of surface hydrology at UC Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Scott, how did we get into all these fires? Why are today's fires so catastrophic?
Well, I do think, like you just mentioned, that's legacy of really fire suppression for over 100 years now. Really, the early foresters looked at the land, thought it was actually understocked with trees, thought that they could actually do better to get more wood for America's people, and decided fire needed to come out. So you take a system and take fire out for so many years, a fundamental piece of that ecology, you're going to change it drastically. And that's what we've done in a lot of forests in California.
And so, Sally, tell us about what this unusual area of Yosemite is where fires have been allowed to burn. What's going on there?
Well, the area is called the Illilouette Creek Basin, and it's a wilderness area in Yosemite National Park. As part of treating it as a wilderness area in the 1970s, the park decided that we should stop interfering with the natural process of wildfires and instead allow those fires to burn. And that has allowed really the natural fire regime to be re-established. And Scott's work in that basin has demonstrated that we're now getting a fire there at any given point in the basin about once every 7 years. The reason we started finding this surprising is that the ecologists walking around were finding that areas that had been dry forests would burn, and that the plants that were coming up were now plants that we would normally see growing in wetlands. So we think something very interesting might be happening.
So the natural forest as it used to be was not returning.
It was not returning. And of course, this is early stage. It may yet turn into a forest again. But this initial process of succession was transforming the landscape into something quite different.
So you were getting a wetland there where you had a forest.
And we were talking about places that were lodgepole pine forests. This is normally a dry sort of place. You know, we go in and we measure water content in lodgepole pine forests today. And by the time we're at this point in the summer, there's no water left in the soil. But these burned areas, we go and measure the water content. There's a water table, maybe a couple of feet below the soil surface. And even at the surface of the soils are still wet.
How does the water get there? Where is it coming from? Do you know, Sally, where it's coming from? Or just rainwater accumulating?
Well, it's snow water, of course, when we're talking about Yosemite National Park. We don't have 100% of the answer to that story, but what we do know is that when we take a big, dense forest, it has a tremendous demand to use water to sustain its own processes of photosynthesis. Big forests also have deep root systems, so they can get at that water from a very large area in the subsurface. If we take that out, we've taken out a lot of the demand for that water in the short term. So we think there's just extra water in the landscape in the Illilouette Creek Basin. And some of that is probably becoming concentrated by topography and by geology into these new wetlands.
Wow. As Scott, and fires are pressing reset on the type of plants that recolonize the landscape in other places too, right?
They sure are. You know, we're seeing areas that, you know, patches. It's one thing about Illilouette's just fascinating. You can go there. You can just walk there out of Yosemite Valley for maybe about a three-hour hike. You can see all these patches of forest. Once it was continuous, we've got a set of air photos, 1969-70, where we see really a canopy of trees for everywhere. And Illilouette actually had 100 years of suppression, just like the Forest Service. Their fires were out of there until 1974. The last fire was 1875. We got a record of it. So you go in there today, 3 acres, 2 acres, patches, openings, other areas, dense forests. The mosaic of vegetation there is phenomenal. And I think that's part of the dynamics is why we're seeing maybe changes in hydrology and also increases in forest resiliency. The forest is very resilient today to fire and climate change.
So what happens? Why does not another fire come in and burn through these areas?
Well, they still do today. You know, yeah. Lightning fires are actually occurring there. The park, with its management, tries to allow all the fires to actually occur. They do smoke out the Yosemite Valley sometimes, maybe a little bit of suppression. But the since the continuity is so low, when the fire moves, it doesn't have the chance to really increase its severity, increase its flame lengths. It hits a discontinuity, goes to the ground, goes over here and goes out. We even did one study that if an area had burned 9 years previously, so the interval between fires was 9 years or less, and 95% of the time, the fire went out at the boundary with no human action.
Now, can you apply this knowledge to these large fires or the areas where these large fires are occurring?
I think you could, because if you look today, you know, we know we have problems with forest restoration. We know we have problems with the climate change. So today, I think it's an exciting opportunity maybe to think of Illilouette, as Sally's described, and actually think, how can you move that maybe different parts of the states, both to increase resiliency of forest to fire and climate change, and also potentially to change hydrology, things like aquatic ecosystems and downstream users. So the Forest Service is out now doing its plan revision throughout the state of all national forests. The last plans were revised in 1980. So this is an opportunity really of a generation.
Can you learn anything about how global warming is reshaping the kinds of vegetation that's growing?
You can, too, because we're seeing, snow is melting earlier. It's a drier environment. And we do have a Kate Wilkin, one of my PhD students at Berkeley, is actually looking at this very question, looking at really what's happening in the understory and the diversity of the understory. And the diversity of the understory is incredibly diverse in the Illilouette Creek. Even the pollinators, another student looking at pollinators finds that the pollinators are diverse. So ecosystems seem to be much more in tune with the diversity and also the dynamics of the ecology.
Sally, are there other places where you've been able to observe this same kind of phenomena?
So in California, in the Sierra Nevada, there's only one other basin that has been allowed to develop this natural fire regime, and that's also in a national park, in Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park. Again, it's a wilderness area, and it's called Sugarloaf Creek Basin. Our difficulty with Sugarloaf Creek Basin is that by comparison to Yosemite, it hasn't had the same level of observations and management applied. So while we can, for instance, measure the stream flow downstream of the Illilouette Creek Basin in Yosemite National Park, we don't have any equivalent measurements of hydrology and even of the weather in Sugarloaf Creek. So we're very suspicious that very similar things might be going on, but at this point we just don't have the data available to be able to say exactly what's happening there.
Mm-hmm. Now that you've learned all this interesting stuff about how to prevent forest fires by allowing natural processes to happen, can you convince politicians? I mean, this has got to be, no pun intended, a politically hot topic. Right. Letting forest fires burn. Yeah.
And there would be some places where that would not be a good policy response, right? So we shouldn't be doing that on the outskirts of Los Angeles. What we are going to be advocating when we start putting these results before policymakers is to be thinking very strategically about the regions where this is likely to be useful and feasible. And so some of the constraints that really come into play are, of course, how isolated an area is, its proximity to some sensitive set of users who you just don't want to be exposing to a fire risk, but also issues around air quality, as Scott's already mentioned. And finally, we need to think carefully if water is going to be part of our rationale for thinking about fire management. We need to think strategically about where this is going to have the greatest value. And that's likely to be in places where right now forests are chewing up mm-hmm. the largest part of the water balance.
Is there any pushback from environmentalists?
Well, this is an interesting question. You know, I think in some ways, most environmentalists in the state really like to see fire begin to work land more. The challenge is we're seeing some fires work land, like the Rim Fire, the King Fire. These are fires in the Yosemite area that actually have burned in the last few years where 250,000 acre fire, but patches of mortality in excess of 10,000 acres. So those types of fires are outside this desired range of variation. We're not getting forced back. We're basically going to have climate change impacts. So I think it is possible that you could actually get more people interested in this. And right now with the plans going forward in California, the three national forests that are ahead of this are the Sequoia, Sierra, and the Inyo. And I think they've actually designated over 50% of their land base potentially for fire use in managed wildfire.
But what about environmentalists who may say, you know, if you put out these fires or if you don't put out the fires, isn't there wildlife, owls, whatever, that you're not going to be saving?
That's a great point. You know, you look at the California spotted owl now, and this is actually something that's being discussed in the state right now, is can you actually have resilient forests with the conservation of the owl? I think the past practices have been trying to maintain the owl's habitat everywhere it exists today, almost like putting artificial boxes around it. Artificial boxes around forest landscapes not going to work. So the idea then is, can you actually think about maybe a conservation strategy that allows the owl to prosper, maybe in a more limited range, but also allow the forest itself to basically evolve and be resilient? So, yes, there are real questions about wildlife, probably the biggest issue.
Can this be applied to other parts of the country, this kind of idea?
I think it absolutely can. This policy of fire suppression is not unique to the Western United States. And in fact, the southeast of the country is well known as an area where fire has shaped ecosystems. And the longleaf pine ecosystems down on the Georgia, South Carolina coast are perhaps the prototypical example of that, where those those savannas just aren't persistent in the absence of fire. I don't think we know very much at all about the effects of fire regime on water in general. So whether this is going to be universally the right solution for thinking about better water management in our forests is likely to be much more site specific. It's an open question in my mind.
But are people now, considering what other alternatives you don't or do have, are they more open to listening to these sorts of things?
I think they are, because if you look, just like you say, you know, what's going on today, continued fire suppression costing us $1.5 billion per annum now, more and more areas being lost, structures lost. So the equivalent is continue to do this forever or look for a different means, a different trajectory. I think the trajectory we're talking about makes a lot of sense.
So where do you go from here? What kind of other research would you like to? What else do you need to know?
Well, we actually need to know an awful lot more than
Tell
we currently
that.
Tell
do. Us about that.
So right now, I guess the fundamental issue that we're confronted with in trying to make sense of what we see up in Illilouette Creek is that when folks changed the fire management, they weren't thinking about water and they weren't thinking about biodiversity and they weren't thinking about any of these other issues. So we don't have very good baseline data. So right now we are in a process of really trying to quantify what's happened, trying to characterize the kinds of changes in vegetation that have actually happened. And through really historical detective work and trying to pin down the mechanisms that are relevant. If we can pin down mechanisms, we're in a much better position to make predictions in other places.
What kind of mechanisms are you talking about?
Well, this is a snow-dominated landscape, and it turns out we know very little about the interaction of snow and fire, which is surprising, right? Because we have so much fire in our mountain catchments. So the sorts of things that we're really interested in is how important, for example, is the role of changing the forest structure for how the snowpack behaves versus that problem I already mentioned of how much water the trees want to use. And those are two things that happen at very different times of the year. Black stumps get a heck of a lot hotter than trees that are covered in snow. So the melt dynamics of the snowpack in spring are likely to be very different in these burned landscapes. That might be a really good thing. That might get that water into the soil, into the rivers much earlier than it otherwise would be, rather than sitting there as snow that can sublimate back to the atmosphere. But we don't really know which of these is the dominant mechanism.
And you're going to have a lot, you have a lot less snow in the snowpack now also, right?
In some places, yes.
So you have to figure that in?
Well, we're really hoping for that El Nino this year so that we can actually have some snow to measure. That has been a challenge. We've been looking at this in the context of drought.
Yeah, we talked about the El Nino versus the blop.
Yeah, we're gunning for the El Nino at this end of the table.
How much research is there really into forest science, about what goes on in forest science? Is a lot of money poured into it? Let me give you the Scott. I'll ask you both, Sally. The blank check question I give my guests sometimes, which is: if you had an unlimited blank check amount of money, where would you put that money? What do you need to know? Where would you like to invest that money? Sally. You can go first, Scott. Scott.
I think one thing, I like the idea of this interdisciplinary work. You know, I've been working in Illilouette now for about 10 years, and having Sally in here, you know, looking at the hydrology piece, we're also looking at carbon sequestration and carbon kind of how much force can the carbon get into that forest. So the idea of interdisciplinary work working together is cool. And then forest research is being funded moderately. It's a lot better than it was 20 years ago. There's a joint fire sciences program that actually funds research on a call every year. So money is out there to do some of this work.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, coming to you from San Francisco and talking about what everybody's talking about here. If it's either the lack of water, it's the big forest fires. Talking with Sally Thompson, Scott Stevens. Sally, do you have a blank check that you could use someplace?
Well, of course.
Never got a no on this question, ever.
No, I'm sure you haven't. I think in for the sake of this particular problem, we could really use a lot more test cases to explore. I mean, the fundamental limitation of everything that I've told you today about the Illilouette Creek Basin is I'm talking about one site, and it has a unique geology, it has a unique history. It would be fantastic, for the sake of understanding this problem, to be replicating the experiment of the Illilouette Creek Basin in 10 or 15 other locations that spanned things like the rainfall snow gradient in the Sierras, that also picked up different vegetation types and different geologies, and really, as we've already alluded to, went right across the country.
Yeah, so you're looking for partners to do this in other places. Would you be helping them or guiding them, or what other places, for example?
Well, to start with, what we'd really like to be able to do is to use what we've learned as motivation to try doing this in other places. And this is where really working collaboratively, as Scott's saying, across disciplines is very helpful, because Scott heads up, at least in California, a coalition of fire science researchers. So we have potentially lots of partners right up and down the state to work with. The challenges are really, as you've already alluded to, in convincing people that this is a safe and reasonable thing to do. And so we're sort of at the beginning of that process.
And there's one other place. The Gila Wilderness in New Mexico is another very large area that's had managed wildfire for 30, 40 years, and also the Bob Marshall, and also in Montana, Idaho. So there are a couple other places one could actually work and actually look at some of these issues today.
But you've got to be able to bring people in and show them this and say, look, your eyes aren't lying to you. This is what happens when we... Right? They bring people in and say,
take a look at this. I think right now we can show people their eyes and show these sort of transformations. What I'm not yet feeling like I have the perfect numbers for is, you know, this is what it means at the large landscape scale. So really, we have to talk about this as being a work in progress in that sense.
Yeah, because the Forest Service has been allowing these fires, putting out the fires for 100 years, right?
They have.
When did that start as a practice? I guess you can't look at a fire and not say, we have to put it out.
I think that started right around 1905. Forest Service was created in 1905 by legislation from Congress. And one of its first two missions was actually, after a short deliberation, is to put out fires really for timber production. The idea was, you know, you got 40 trees per acre in the Sierra Nevada. Looking at all that open ground, they said, well, we can get 200 or 300 trees if we get the fire out. So they did it in good reason. You know, if I put myself back in 1905, I might have made the same choice. But today, with 100 years of experience, we now know that forests are in such more vulnerable conditions that early idea of trying to get more timber for the U.S. population was a good idea, but it went sour.
Are you hopeful this will work out?
Actually,
yeah,
I am.
Optimistic.
Yeah, even if we look back into the late 1990s, the Forest Service has been very self-reflective and self-critical of the consequences of fire suppression. And I think there's a lot of scientific will behind changing that.
Well, thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Scott Stevens, Professor of Fire Science at the Department of Environmental Science, Policy and Management, UC Berkeley, also Berkeley. Sally Thompson, Professor of Surface Hydrology there. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.